Log Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Well, good evening and welcome to Lenny Gottfried's Straight No Chaser. Yes, we are on tonight. We haven't been here for a little bit, but I'm coming back to you with such a wonderful guest. You will say, well, this was worth the wait. So, before I start anything, let me just say that I am Lenny Gottfried. And you are listening to Lenny Gottfried's Straight No Chaser on blogtalkradio.com/S as in Sam, F as in Fred, T as in Tom, H as in Harry, and the number 2. If you want to dial in, then you can dial in at 516-453-6063. And if you have a question, then you press the number 1. And I will see that you have something that you want to say, and I'll put you on the air. You can ask the question of myself or the guest, and then at that point in time, we will be able to answer your question. So thank you so very much for listening. That's a bit of the house cleaning that I do every episode, just to make sure that everyone knows where they are. Some people are tuning in for the first time because they're excited about the guests that we're having tonight, and I think you should be. Some people are just are old fans, and we want to make sure that they are comfortable with, you know, where they are. So I really want to thank you all so much for really, you know, tuning in and making sure that we are all on the same page. Now, with that in mind, let me just say that I want to be able to introduce you to this young lady. It is very interesting how we met, because I met her under another circumstance as a playwright. And we will talk about her writing, we will talk about her plays, and then as we had a conversation about whether or not we would work together on the play, we got into another conversation about other things that she did. And one of the things, the other thing that she talked about was her, I call it, financial wizardry. And I have to tell you, she's very modest, because I asked her, I said, well, tell me a couple of things about yourself. And she sent a brief bio, and it tells a little bit about it. I'm going to read it to you, but we're going to also explore the rest of her life and why she got here, and also the contributions that she makes to the community, whether it is the community at large or the theatrical community, and what she does in a creative way as well as a financial way. So let me introduce you to Aquila Barnes of the financial service firm Barnes Financial Concierge. She is guided creatives and small business owners with tax accounting and financial planning solutions to protect and grow their money so that they have the freedom to focus on what they love to do most. Isn't that what we all want to do? So with 20-plus years of experience, she has helped clients realize more than $1.5 million in tax savings. Now, that's just the beginning. That's just telling you where she is now. And I want to let her come in, say hello, and then I want to just explore so much about her. Say hello to the audience, Aquila Barnes. You're on the air.
Hello, and thank you, Lenny Gottfried, for having me on today. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to having this conversation about numbers and art.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because I think one of the things that really is difficult about our business is the financial part of it. It's a lot of the times you don't have a lot of the financial support that you really want to have in order to do your business. And when you do, you don't know how to really navigate it to make it healthy and for it to have longevity. So one of the things that,
correct,
you know, we really want to hear is some of the things that can help you with that. But before we get to that, I want to talk about how I first met you in under the circumstances. Essence of Acting, of course, is my nonprofit, and everyone, you know, a lot of people know that I'm artistic director of that. And we are always looking for wonderful projects, new projects, that create another slant on the community of people that look like us, that are people of color. And sometimes we find old plays and do them with people of color, which gives it a whole nother flavor. But in this case, you were very good friends with Valeska Cambron.
Mm-hmm.
I always say Cambron. She says it's Cambron. And I always want to roll the R's, you know. And we were looking for a play, and she said, I think I have a friend that has a play, and I'm going to ask her if she's interested in submitting the play to Essence of Acting and see how that goes. So you did, and that started
mm-hmm.
our relationship with the name of the play, ladies and gentlemen, is The Cost. And oh my, oh my, oh my. It is a page turner, which that's what it is. When I read plays, if I'm constantly turning the page, if I don't pause because I want to see what the next thing is about, then I know this is a play that I'm interested in either directing, being in, or producing. And tell us about how you came to writing this play and how it was it influenced by your background, by your childhood, by your education. I just want to know all of it. Just talk to me, Aquila. Talk to me.
Talk to you. Okay. The Cost, like many of the plays I write, are inspired by unanswered questions, me searching for something. And this play, it deals with politics in a family. And so the dynamics of that was exciting to me. So I admit I was first inspired from the Obama campaign. The drama, like, you know, it was good drama too, you know. It was like the hope,
yes,
the potential for a first black president, the issues that would come up that would make us go, oh, he might not win now, or he might not be voted for.
Yeah,
and
something else would happen.
You remember all that? It was like a circus, and it always is that in politics, but for some reason I paid attention on another level with like, oh, this is dramatic. Even once we knew he was going to be the president, he had to announce his vice president. That was dramatic. We were all waiting for that text message to come out. So all of that, this inspired the idea of exploring what happens behind the scenes with that. What are the people dealing with? What's the family dealing with? And my mother said something to me years ago. I volunteered for campaigns growing up. And she said something to me throughout this process. She said, politics keep you from doing what's right for the country, and that's wrong.
Oh.
And I had to sit with that. Politics keep you from doing what's right for the country, and that's wrong. And this idea that sometimes politics get in the way of doing what you really want to do or what the right thing is to do. And
it is difficult because there's so much compromise involved.
So much compromise with what you can say, where you can say, who you are, how you represent. And so I just went deep into that. I dealt with this is a black family. The brother, you know, would be the first African-American governor of this state. It's from the Midwest, and I'm from the Midwest. I want to explore that. He has a sister who is rightly talented, maybe even more talented than he, who's asked to be his campaign manager. And because of her relationships, she has a father still, she shouldn't be in the forefront. You know, he has a dad who has an old, kind of remind me of Jesse Jackson. I like Jesse Jackson and Jesse Jackson Jr., the son, and like these generational perspectives on politics.
Yes, Yes.
Just what all of that coming together in the Midwest and this opportunity and how and what cost, what are they willing to pay to win? And that's what was swirling on my mind, and I wanted to deal with the family dynamics and the challenges, what people will and won't do, and how people, can they be themselves? Can they do what's right, you know, regardless? So that was the inspiration. That was it.
Well, I have to tell you, and you mentioned that you're from the Midwest, so we're gonna go back and talk about that in a little while. But the fascinating thing about it is that, you know, in reading it, I'm always driven when I feel like I know these people, like I know someone that's like that, whether I know them personally or not. And they were so complete, the caricatures that you wrote, the character-driven incentives that they had. It was so complete, so human, and it wasn't. I have to say it like this: it wasn't based on the fact that they happened to be black, but it wasn't a black, you know, driven kind of thing, because being black is human. So it was a human driven thing.
And
so therefore, not a lot of the things that were dealt with there had to be justified in there being a cultural difference from anybody else. It was the fact that it was situational. It was just situational.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing came after the other thing. I mean, it would be just one. Just when you thought, oh, I'm taking a breath now. Here comes the ex-boyfriend. And what that is all about, and how his ego and what his ego is about, and all of those things. It's just amazing, you know, what all of that, just one thing after another. And yes, the traditionalists, we all have dealt with people in our family who are traditionalists. Something works and they think, okay, this is the way it has to be all the time. But you have to be cognizant of the fact that things change. There's nothing constant but change. And so the adjustment to that and how people's lifestyles, people's choices, their lifestyle choices, all of those things change. And it's important.
It
really is important to acknowledge that. So it was all of those elements. And I guess the audience is saying, well, are you doing the play, Lenny? Well, that was the funny thing. The reason why we had to talk is at this point in time, I'm hoping that there may be people in the audience who will get interested in this play and pick this play up. And I'd be interested in working with them on that, because at this point, it's not the right play for Essence of Acting and our company. But it is a play that I think that if a theater really had a vision of telling a story about people who happened to be, they just happen to be black, and how that echoes in our society, that we have the same situations as everybody else, and how do we get through them, and our cadences and our speech patterns and what we deal with. I'm hoping that this is something that we are going to be enjoying for a long time in the future. That's what I'm hoping.
Thank you for that.
I'm going to get to the childhood, but talk about the plays. What other kinds of plays were you interested in writing as a playwright?
Yeah, it's always a lot of family stories. So there's a play that I did write coming out of school that I expanded later, called My People, My People, and it was examining, like, what does it mean to be black in America? And when I came out of college, I remember thinking, somebody's telling me I'm black, it has to look like this, or I have to speak this way, or I have to, you know, say this, or I see people judging someone else about the representation of being an African American. And I was like, I don't think anyone has a point to be able to say that everyone should act this way or look this way or be this way.
So it's
a story. It's sort of an abstract story, but it's a story of I think it's six black people who end up in an alley with a homeless man. And they all represent different facet aspects, yes, and they're all challenged to kind of be together, kind of stuck in this alley for a moment, and they're challenged to sort of get to know each other, and they have these perspectives. And I just wanted to explore
and,
again
and, yeah,
the question.
Past the physicality, mm-hmm. past the circumstances.
Past the physicality,
yeah.
past the circumstances, like who are you? And you have the
yeah.
right to be who you are, and I get a chance to see you beyond that and understand who you are. You represent America, too. You represent human race, too, you know? So that
yes,
was
exactly.
a fun play. And, yeah, and another one I've written that I've performed, done a lot of readings with, is called Hush Hush. And it's also about, this is about a family that has, the young woman, it's an adult woman who comes home to visit her family. And it's based on a book. And it's based on actually a nonfiction book that the book interviews. And she comes mm. home and she's dealing with something from the past that happened. Some
uh-huh.
trauma, some sexual
uh-huh.
abuse from the past. And she's showing up and
uh-huh.
it's kind of like, what do we do with this now? This happened years ago. Like, what do we do with this now? And it's dealing with
uh-huh.
also other family dynamics, like just being away, going off to school, coming back. It's dealing with aunts and mothers and just where should we be now? This beautiful family that may have this piece of history, and how do you move
uh-huh.
through it? So,
uh-huh.
again, just family dynamics and how do we choose to deal with things, you know, how we choose to move forward, how we choose to, what's our perspective on it, from different, you know, ages, different, you know, roles in the family. So that's some of the things that
Then tell me, it sounds like family is a very important part of it. So tell me then about
yes.
your beginnings. Where are you naturally from?
I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but I moved
mm-hmm.
to Indianapolis, Indiana, at age 3. I think my parents moved at age 3. So I'm a NapTown girl from Indianapolis, Indiana, raised, went to high school, grade school, high school, and went to college at Purdue, which is 45 minutes from Indianapolis.
Okay.
So I'm from Indiana, and that's where most of my family on my father's side specifically is from, yes.
Well, where were your parents from? You started off in Wisconsin. So were they both
yes.
naturally in Wisconsin? Did they start in Wisconsin? Were they born and raised in Wisconsin?
No, my actually met in Indianapolis, and my grandmother moved to Wisconsin. So my mother went with her, and then my dad and mom decided to be together and leave Wisconsin and come back to Indianapolis.
I see.
Yeah, in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now Purdue,
yeah.
all right. And so how does
yes.
that get you here in the New York area? Now how does that get you?
Oh, wow.
What's that journey?
Purdue. So Purdue was amazing because you know, I started off at Purdue majoring in mechanical engineering. So that journey,
Well, let me stop you right there. You got to stop right there. Mechanical engineering. What was the incentive for that?
Yeah, let me back up a little bit. Okay, so.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about. Now I hear numbers all over the place. Go ahead.
Yes, so I always said I was born to write. I knew at age 9, that's like my first time I could hear sort of like spirit or something speaking to me saying, you know, write. But I was really good, and I was really good with numbers. So when I was in junior high school, it was around the time that they were trying to expand the engineering programs, particularly looking for minorities to go into engineering programs. And my parents are both accountants, so my father, who's no longer with us now, faster, but they're both accountants mm-hmm. growing up. So I was in this place of writing in the Midwest, right? Very supporting arts, but really supportive a sports town, you know, the Pacers.
Yes, my husband went to the University of Wisconsin, so I know a lot
okay.
about the Midwest and supporting of the arts. It fascinates me. It just fascinates me. Yes, yes.
Yeah, so So growing up in this household with accountants, really good with numbers,
yes.
I love numbers, you know, and I've excelled in the calculus and all of that. When it was time to go to school, I was encouraged to go into engineering, and I chose mechanical engineering. So this is what happened. I went to Purdue, got accepted. I was on the track. I was in engineering for 2.5 years. By grace, I had 2.5 years. I had 3 internships in engineering before my freshman year, between freshman and sophomore, between sophomore and junior year. By the time I got to the third one, even before that, I was like, I cannot do this for a living. I love numbers. I cannot. And I had to come tell my mother, and I was like, I'm sorry, but I can't change my major. I'm not happy. Like, I would go to the internships, and it's like, this is boring to me. It's not enough stimulation for me. And I love numbers. At the same time, I was a part of the Black Cultural Center at Purdue, and I was given the opportunity to write my first play. They're like, you know, you like writing? Why don't you write a play? So all that was swirling around at the same time. Like, I'm in school. I'm good with numbers, but there's an opportunity to write. I get to explore that at the university. And I changed paths and came out in a different direction. So I came out, and I'll tell you this. I didn't want to go into accounting because I think my parents were accountants. It was more one of the positions.
Ah, okay. So you didn't want to follow that route. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what it was. Yeah, and I look back on it now. Back then, I was like, they're accountants. And I was like, oh, I'm going to do something different. So by the time I came out and graduated, though, shortly after, I joined my mother, and we started an accounting practice. We started doing taxes and started doing payroll.
Wow, isn't that interesting? Kind of, yeah, okay.
I found myself way to it, and I continued to write. And what really shifted for me was the idea of doing it all as an entrepreneur. I think if I had done anything in the sciences or math as an employee, you know, for me personally, it would have been sort of like a little bit of a confining experience for me, but the idea that I could be an entrepreneur and create this. Remember that we created the practice from scratch. We chose our clients. We chose how we would offer services. We decided we wanted to value education in our tax, you know, services, our accounting services, and it made it interesting to me in a different way. And taxes, in particular, is different than some basic accounting. So I kind of was leaning towards the idea of solving problems every year. If tax law changes, it changes. How do you solve problems? Then I moved to New York, and I got married to my ex-husband out of college.
Uh-huh.
Got divorced some years
uh-huh.
later, and I was like,
okay.
I'm gonna, you know, I was kind of going through a thing emotionally. You know what I mean? Just I thought we would be married forever, and sort of a little depressed as well. And the writing exploded, meaning the poetry side of the writing. I began to write more, and I said, I'm going to go to New York and hang out for a year. I'm going to hang out for a year, see how plays are developed in New York, and I'm going to go back to Indianapolis and get back to my life. 23 years later, I'm still here. And while I was working, at the Public Theater, stage managing, so I could just be in the room with George Wolf, be in the room with, there was a number of people I wanted to be in the room with, to Tony Kushner, Carolina Change.
Mm-hmm.
I was stage managing, you know, being a production assistant on these shows to watch and learn. I even went on tour with my cousin. We took a tour out, Malik Yoba, and we toured, and I got to see what does it take to produce a show. I met someone at the Public on one of those shows, and I don't know how it came up. I said, I'm not going to tell anyone I do taxes because I'm leaving. I'm going back to Indianapolis. I'm just going to hang out and go back to and get, you know, get back to life and get serious and do some
right things. Yeah.
And so I told someone I do taxes, and she's like, I don't know how it came out. We were backstage, and she goes, can you do my taxes? I'm like, sure. She told somebody. They told somebody. There was a lot of students come out of Yale, out of the grad program, out of design and lighting design and set design, and she told a couple of them, and you know, and it just grew. They word of mouth spread. And next thing you know, I was doing taxes. And, you know, 3 years later, I'm here. 4 years later, I said, let me make a decision. Am I staying here? What am I doing? And I just, you know, 23 years later, we have a practice that's really designed to, it serves creatives, it serves entrepreneurs, small business owners, and we have over 200 clients. And it just morphed into this thing where I can still be creative. I can be creative somewhat in the practice. And I can still do my art and represent and then support other creatives and entrepreneurs who struggle with understanding this, you know, the numbers and taxes and accounting and, you know, how do I manage my business? And so I found a way to make it, just make it a wonderful experience for me. And I'm still designing that, you know, but I loved it. And here I am today.
Well, I mean, I think what you how you describe it in your bio, the essence it, you describe it in just the short little passage that captures, I think, what most artists really want to be able to do, and that is, I'm trying to turn this page right now, to have the freedom to focus on doing what they love most. That, even though I say to people, money is not everything, it is a vehicle by which it does give you an amount of freedom and amount of power where your choices then are not dependent upon something because you have to do it because you need the money. Right. And as my husband, I'm married to a financial analyst. That's why I'm so fascinated by you. my husband says, the money, you should not work for the money. The money should work for you.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to that point, when you understand that, when it may not do it all the time, but when that is one of the functions that you have, then your whole outlook becomes different, and you then are empowering yourself with something. Now, this may not be encouraging to a lot of people in the business who depend upon people being dependent so that they have to do these roles that they, you know. So this may not be great news for a lot of people, but I believe it is really good news for those people who have crossed over to a certain section and time in their lives where they really want to do what they want to do, what they have been longing to do. Some people don't get an opportunity to do it until they retire. Some people do some planning. But I think in everybody's heart who has the passion to love creativity of all kinds, you want to be able to have the freedom to be able to make those choices. And I think you captured that absolutely, perfectly. And so what it evolved, isn't that interesting that word of mouth became exactly how it is that you have a business now that is thriving, two businesses that are parallel one another, that really do feed one another, because being in the industry as a playwright and being exposed to those people in our business who are creative, the need is also to always understand what we should and be trying to do with our money.
Yeah.
And so it's the playwriting feeds the financing feeds the playwriting.
Yes.
You know, the freedom to do the playwright, the freedom to do the costume design, the freedom to record a record. All of that, all of those freedoms are so very, very important. And and that is, you know, that's what's fascinating about what it is that you've, you know, where you've come to at this point in time. And the evolution of it, the, knowing that both of your parents were accountants, that says something, you know, that the atmosphere in which you were raised. Like I said, when you are in a relationship with someone where numbers are an important thing, numbers are such an exact thing that people are very exact about it. They're exact about it in their timing. They're exact about it in how they plan. I say this being married to a financial analyst. And one of the things that I thought that I really found fascinating about him, like my father, who was not an educated man, but was based on finite things, is that the timing was always important. If you had to be someplace, if he would say, I'm someplace at 6:30, 6:15, he'd be pulling up. So, you know, between 6 o'clock and 6, so those are, that's my influence with all of that. I think it's a very important thing that that influence early on you see the world through that way. I think. But now, so describe to me your typical client and your typical producer, because now I can talk to you as a playwright and I can talk to you as a financial advisor. So what would be when you talk to a producer about your play, period, about any of the plays that you're doing, what is the approach that you do, knowing all of the financial challenges that happen in the atmosphere of the theater that we have now? Because theater is very different than it was when I first started a long time ago, and it is corporate based. A lot of it is politically based. Mm-hmm. A lot of it. It wasn't so much that before. It wasn't an area where people cared to even invest their time politically into it, because it wasn't thriving. It is now a thriving business where people can become millionaires. So that is attractive to that. How do you have a conversation with someone who is thinking about doing one of your plays financially?
Mm.
How does that go?
Good question. So if I'm talking with a producer about producing one of my plays, I think I naturally have my business hat on. So I think the difference might be is that I'm not just a writer who's like, will you do this and I'm waiting for you to do it. I like to have involvement, meaning I could be a part of planning the budget, really the budget piece more than anything. I'm not the kind of person who's going to be hands-on. Like, I need to be in who's how you're casting. I want to help hire the person who's designing, make sure everything is set. I'd like to make sure the big picture is flowing. So if I can be a part and bring that as a co-producer, I welcome that.
Mm-hmm.
And hope that a producer will say, come on board and bring that business mindset. Let's look at the budget. What do we have to work with? How do we break that down by department? What can we do with that? And then managing that money week by week through the production. I have written the play, I give it over to the director, stage manager. I let them be and do their thing. I don't touch the writing anymore unless they want me to or something, right? I really let that go. And I just really want to be a part of seeing it be successful. And I really care about it being financially successful. And I care about the actors and the team and the designers and the team being paid. And that's my thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an important thing, because what happens is that the investment that all of those people, the stage manager, as you stage manage, all the tech people, the performers and all of the investment of time that they do, the longer the show runs, the more benefits they have. So to prepare it so it can have longevity is really, that's the key, I think, in really doing it. And, we've got accustomed to shows that are very short runs. So there used to be in the theater, there were no short runs. It's a run of the play contract, and the play usually ran for a couple of years, which helped people kind of recover from some of the time when they weren't earning money. But now there are shorter terms, and it's harder to manage money in a short term kind of situation, because just when you just are recovering, you're back out and out of employment again. So thinking about the longevity of preserving it, and that can only happen when you start doing the preparation of budgets and hiring staff, qualified staff that can keep your show in its running, in its good running form. That becomes, to have someone on board that understands their own play, but understands how to keep the play running, the financial backing of it, is, I believe, an invaluable thing. So that would be the conversation with the producer. What is your typical, generic client in the business? What common issues do you find that your clients have that you have to advise them about?
I say the two things that come to mind when you ask that are managing up and down income. That's the number one thing. how to manage. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a lot of clients. Of course, you know, if you, you know, you're working in theater, you, if you, you say you may work up, be hired for a play that is 6 weeks long, 2 weeks long, you know, maybe a few months,
mm-hmm.
and then you're not, maybe not working 6 months in between. So how to manage that? So the idea that I made this much money over 3 months, I can't spend it as if I'm going to make the same amount of money the next 3 months because I don't know. So we work with them to think ahead. We have clients, for example, who book shows a lot. You know, they were maybe working on a play and then book a TV show. All of a sudden, they're making $400,000 over 3 months. So we
mm-hmm.
have to think through
mm-hmm.
the taxes on that. So that's a lot of, it's a big jump.
Yes.
We think through
yes.
what tax structure should you be? It doesn't make sense if you're going to make that kind of money in that period of time, typically, to be paid as a W-2. We want to get your S-Corp set up and have the production
mm-hmm.
pay you through your S-Corp or your C-Corp. So we talk through that, and then we walk through the management of cash flow. Like, okay, so made $400,000. Maybe the show will get a second season. Maybe it won't. Maybe it'll get a third season, and maybe we'll have a strike. Like we're having that, you know, we had experience.
Exactly.
So,
all of those elements, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. all those elements. So you can't spend that money as if it's going to be there forever. It's about the planning. So that's a typical client, how to get their head around, oh, I just got $400,000. Yes, 10% went to my agent, 10% went to my manager, and I got to see the rest. And I get to then deduct expenses and pay taxes on what's left over. So it's a constant
uh-huh.
reminder to them of like, okay, this is what came in. Pay that agent fees, management fees, expenses, the travel, you know, meals with, you know, colleagues, blah, 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 blah. This is the taxes. Let's set that aside right now. Pay it in advance. Now this is what you have
exactly.
left over. And
right.
then what you have left over,
right.
how much do we save for the rainy day? So that's a typical client where we're managing up and down income, or one partner may receive a W-2 and the other one works like that, you know.
Right.
That's a typical, yeah.
Yeah, I think the difficult part is planning for that roller coaster up and down. Making yourself available so that you are eligible for work, but also finding that maybe that instrumental job that allows you to live a normal life while you are waiting to live this irregular life. It's not normal.
Mm-hmm.
It's abnormal. The life of a performer, of a designer, it's go from job to job to job to be an independent contractor is what we are,
and
to go from job to job to job and understand how to sustain that so that you are healthy 12 months out of the year, even if you only work 6 or 7 months or 3 months. But knowing how to sustain that and keeping that, you know, friends of mine would always say, Lenny, I can never tell when you're working and when you're not working. I said, yep, that's right. You know, it's finding that neutrality that you can sustain. There are people who I know who have major television jobs who
mm-hmm.
are very wise, who did not buy houses to impress anyone else. They bought houses that they could maintain whether that show was going to run for a year, 5 years, or 10 years. That would be something that after the show closed, they could still maintain that mortgage.
Given the
other choices that they had invested in before. Maybe they invested in real estate that would give them, you know, monies over time, in businesses, investments that could, you know, could do all of that. I think that becomes... That becomes the issue of someone who has a little bit more experience and is hired a little bit more. But what about that freshman person, that these young people who are coming in now, who I always think that they, like in the NFL and somebody, the NBA, now they have classes for these young people, whether they're women or men,
right.
who begin to make, interesting amounts of money and show them how they what they need to do to sustain themselves past their 10 years because, you know, an athlete, a dancer, you know, that's very, very physical. You've got 10, 12 years of really hard work, and then you've got maybe another 3 or 4 where you can fake it and, you know, and work with aging and injuries and everything else like that. But that's the low side of 20 years. What do you do then with the next 20, 30, maybe 40 years of your life? How do you sustain that? How do you project that? Is that something that comes into the conversation with you with younger people maybe?
Absolutely. So I've done a series of classes where I taught at Rutgers and Yale and like Montclair State, and it's two students who are about to come out, you know, design careers, different careers. And one of the things I talk about or highlight in those sessions, because they're new to it, we do talk about taxes and what a 1099 is versus a W-2. But the thing I really hone on is the idea of the bucket approach. People, financial planners have called it different things over the years, you know, the jars, whatever. But it's the idea that you have to set aside your money with intention. So I don't care if you are making, you know, $10 over your rent and your utilities, your basic cost. What do you do with that $10 every time it comes in? Do you take, you know, and the way we talk about it, so I love this because I have clients who are trying to figure out how to pay their rent sometimes, and we have clients who've inherited millions in their 30s. So we have that range, and we've seen it all. And so the idea is that if you take the bucket, no matter what do you intend for that money? So if you get that habit down early, and you say, okay, bucket one, this is just an example. If you have 3 buckets, you may have more or less, but if you have 3 buckets, bucket one would be your emergency, contingency, you know, the money you want to get your have in cash, maybe in CD, money market, something like that. But you want to be able to get that for an emergency. We determine what that is, you know, and this is interesting conversation you asked for the artist, because for someone who works at a W-2 job, they've been there for 15 years, they feel pretty secure, they have a partner who's also been at their job. Maybe they need 3 months of an emergency fund. Maybe 6 months will be fine. But if you have up and down income, that bucket one, you might want to, you know, you do the best you can, but you may really want to consider 9 months to kind of hold you over comfortably in between. So that's bucket one. Bucket three, I'm going to skip bucket two for a second because I like to sit on bucket two. Bucket three is what we all know is the long term. That's the retirement planning, 401ks, IRAs. It could be college savings for young children, but it's that long-term money that you might invest, you know, knowing you're going to use it at retirement. So, and then bucket two, which is the one I love the most, kind of what I love for the artists, people with an up or down income, consultants who are just not sure. It's that money in that lands between, I say, that 1 to 7 year mark. Money that I'm saving it for an intention. So there's emergency, there's retirement. Bucket two is like 1 to 7 years. 1 to 7 years, and that's what I talk about. The goals could be I'm going to buy a home. I'm going to get married. You know, I want to save for my wedding. I'm going to work. I'm going to take off and go to Europe and study acting, you know, or, you know, go to England somewhere, whatever. Or I live in California. I'm going to come to New York in the summers and study theater. You know, it's that money that's just I'm saving for a purposeful intention. It's not my emergency fund. It's not my long-term retirement. It's for other goals that are in the mix of this. If you begin with that sort of framework, and we switch it up with clients as they need. If you begin with that framework coming out and beginning to work and just save your money with intention, you'll be far better off than a lot of people are. 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, you will have saved. And when that time comes, you know, hey, there is a strike, you may be able to not have to dip into your bucket one because you've got bucket two money to take time off.
You've got that,
you know?
You've got that intention. Oh, that's very interesting.
Intention. Huh. That's, to me, is a key thing. That to me, if you get that, then you'll in the world of uncertainty that we live in anyway, in an industry with artists that it is uncertain a lot of times, that bucket approach to me can save your life and just bring you a lot of ease. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it's amazing. I want to, you know, I want to stop you now because, you know, what happens is that we only have about
11 minutes left, and see how fast this goes.
I know already.
Yes, we only have about 11 minutes left, and I want to make sure that if anyone wants to ask any questions, that you know they have the ability to press on one. That the board is there. It's got people listening. But I think people are listening more than anything else because I think what it is that we are all looking for information that can apply to our different situations, you know, instead of saying, well, I do this for a living, and how can I, like, there's a formula. I don't know if there are formulas that apply to us in anything in life. But there's information that we can gather and apply to our specific situations. And I think my experience with this venue, this media, is that people listen a great deal. Every once in a while they'll ask a question, but they'll listen. Or, you know, I'll get a messenger on Facebook, you know, that guest that you had before, can you ask a question, blah, 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 you know, all of that, after they've had time to think about things. But you talk about, the second bucket is even better than, you know, your five-year plan, your 10-year plan, your two-year plan. What is your five-year plan? I mean, you have this combination of the creative and the corporate, I would say it like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you think that's going to land you? Will it, you know, right now you have a concierge business that about finance. Will you have then a build a business on your creative work and run them tandem or parallel?
Yes, good question. Yes, I absolutely in parallel. I think for me, the challenge has been the balance of the two. You know, I'm fully committed, and I am equally left and right brain. So what I've been building is I've been building this practice that allows me to do both, that allows me to also write and honor that part of me. So in 5 years, I see our Barnes Financial Concierge being like a premier service to support people. And as you said, so people can feel the freedom to focus on doing what they love. That is a place that says, hey, we can support you in that. So whether you are, we have a CFO level service, our team will support you with that. Whether it's, you know, you just need your taxes done and want a tax analysis, we can support you with that. And we have this team that can do it, that where it's not all me doing, but we have a team. And that then allows me space. And then I see myself on the creative side, continue to write, but also being very involved in producing more. I love it more than I realize. I've produced some readings. I've produced some shorter plays. I've been a co-producer. And it's almost like recognizing I cannot not use the gift. I can't just show up as an artist. Sometimes I can do that, but I also really – can bring this other gift to it. So I don't know if it's a production company, maybe. I don't know, but it's definitely seeing more of my work produced and being involved in maybe in partnership, as I talked about earlier, even on other levels of partnership and supporting the work being produced. And in doing that for others as well. I shot some short film pieces, you know, I've learned recently more of the film tax credit process. So how to get, there's always a dance of merging the two, but definitely expanding more of my writing and seeing more of it produced.
What do you think you learned down at the public, you know, sitting in the room with all the wonderful people you were sitting in the room with? What did that do for you?
Sitting in the room, it really made me respect process. It made me respect the team of characters and, I mean, everything that comes together to make it. So the process, so I worked on Carolina Chains, and that's one of the pieces I talk about, because I think we had 3 workshops and then the production at the public before it went to Broadway. And I wasn't with mm-hmm. the Broadway, but I was with these workshops. And so I had never experienced the idea that you could go and you could, you know, come together with the writers and the composer and the musician and team and just try that out with the actors. And like, oh, that didn't work. Take that out next day. Or we do this workshop for 2 weeks
yes.
or 4 weeks.
Yeah.
And just come back in 6 months and let's do it again. And I was like, oh, my God. I mean, because when you're doing things by yourself, there's a pressure to, like, I got to get it done in perfect first time out. So what that taught me, even in business, was it's okay, like, try it out. Just live and live with the failure well, live with the mistake. Don't when you're creating with a team like that, it's not really mistakes. It's what works and what doesn't work. So what I
yes.
learned then in business
yes.
is to see failure as an asset and switch my brain, like, that didn't work. And this is what I learned from that. And it's okay, because now that I'll take that information and I'll do this with it, or I'll share it with my clients. And so that was a great, that probably was the greatest freedom for me, to see that you can work on something over time to get that element of what you really wanted, you know. And I also write poetry. And so I've done that with poetry, but it made me even appreciate even more with the poetry, like, to just feel into what feels right. If it doesn't, you can rewrite it.
I'm hearing is you've developed a sense of flexibility, which means
yes.
that, you know, as much as you are married to what you create, you also are dedicated to the success of it without it losing its aesthetic value. But
right.
if there were changes that needed to be done, you are more flexible, I think, than some playwrights. Some are. Some I've worked with some
mm-hmm.
who are just absolutely, you know, they go, yeah, it's not working. What do you think? You know, that kind of thing. It's delightful, but you also want to be very protective of their work, because
yes.
it is their work. It is your work. It is, you know, it is the job of the person that we're being handed to enhance it, but it's not your job to aesthetically change what is there and what was the statement that was wanted, the statement that it was created to say. And it's a wonderful journey, the process. It does take certain kinds of people. Not everybody is ready for that kind of journey. So
you're right.
It takes a certain kind of bravery, you know, to be able to work on something one day and then come back and have it change the next day. And you've worked on it that
mm-hmm.
night before, thinking that you fixed it, and you're like, oh, okay. But it strengthens your agility. It strengthens your ability to your flexibility. Let me just say that.
Yeah,
it does
yes.
that. You grow. You can sustain things longer. You can do. I don't want to call it multitasking, but you can deal with things more. All right. Now, I see that some people have joined even more on the board. If there are any questions, we only have about 3 minutes. You better press the 1 because then we're going to go to the webinar, and you can go to Facebook and join us in the webinar if you like and ask more questions. But, you know, there have been added more now that I can't see everybody on it because the board is full. But I just want to give them that opportunity. Your stamina is tested. Stamina
yes.
Grows. You know, what you thought was, oh, this is all I can do in a day. You find that you can do that in the first part of the day, and you go, okay, so now what? You know, that's when you know that there's growth. That's when you know that there's really great growth. So, yeah. Well, with that said,
I'm going to, I have a couple of more questions that I want to ask you about the duality of what it is that you do and how you are managing that, but I want to ask you on camera. So we're going to go to the webinar, and you've got the information that, did you get your information this afternoon? You got some, right?
I'm not sure. Let me check.
Yes, check that. It'll take you right there. It will take you right there, that information. And and if not, that's okay. I'll get you there. You know, it's not a big thing. But those people who want to join as attendees, the information that you need as an attendee is on Facebook. It's on my page, Lenny Godfrey, on Facebook. And you're welcome to come in and listen to, you know, we're only going to be doing a few minutes. But listen to the latter part of this conversation. And I'm just fascinated, you know, as to how all of this is going to evolve into your own empire of being able to let these two things merge and two services, because they're two services to a creative community, you know. But with that, I better stop now because I know, you know, it's going to come down. And then, you know, look to see if you have it. If not, give me a call, but we will, I'll go to the webinar and I'll get you on and we will start our conversation in about 2 or 3 minutes. And, you know, anyone who's willing to join us, please join in. I think it will be an interesting end to this conversation. So I thank you, Aquila.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Opening up this window of the ability to have all of the multifacetedness that you have in your life and how all of that has worked. Thank you very much for doing that. It just fascinated me when we were talking about one thing and then you brought that up. I said, you do what? You know, and you do it well, you know, so it is one thing that we really want to let people know about. So, everyone, we will see you next week. My guest next week is Ann Dunning, who is a consultant of many of the nonprofit organizations. And I think that this is another service that you all will be interested in about how things, you know, work on that end of everything. So I will be able to connect and see you all next week on Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. Thank you very much for tuning in. And also, we'll see you on the radio and we'll see you on the webinar. So thank you again. I'll talk to you in a few minutes, Aquila. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Thank you again.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever, in the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know how to love you far away. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever, in the morning, fever all through the night. Bless my soul, I love you, just take this heart away, and you can take these
arms, cause I'll never use them. Just believe every word that I say. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daylight and the moon lights up the night. I light up when you call my name, cause you know I'm gonna treat you right. You give me fever when you kiss me,